Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. Today, we're supposed to be, should have Alan Mackey.
He's
supposed
here.
To be with us.
Here.
Oh, he's there. Good. We have Alan Mackey. He's joining us again. He was with the program approximately 2 weeks ago, and he was talking about many of the things that he's working with the new Progressive Alliance, and also speaking on many of the issues involving left groups. Alan, once again, we'd like to welcome you to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Stuart.
Alan, last time you were a very exciting guest, and you shared a lot of valuable information with our listeners. Today, what I would like to do, we'll start out the same way, if you can take maybe a minute or two, just to share a little bit about your background. And we're going to spend most of this program today sharing about what the new Progressive Alliance is about. Could you just take a minute or two just to share your background, Alan? Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I've been involved in various movements for peace and civil rights for, you know, well over 40 years. And right now I'm working with casino workers that are trying to organize casino workers in the Indian gaming industry. They're forced to work in these smoke-filled casinos at poverty wages and without any rights under state or federal labor laws. I work with casino workers in this industry in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. I've also been working with the group New Progressive Alliance, as you've noted. And our main objective in the New Progressive Alliance is to try to bring people together to create a new political movement in this country to challenge the Democrats and Republicans and ultimately Wall Street for power.
Alan, obviously, well, first of all, I'd like to ask you, who were the founders for the New Progressive Alliance, and what was the impetus where they decided that we need to bring this together for to move ahead on the left?
Well, I really wasn't there for the actual founding. I came on board later, but some of the people that were involved were people like Cornel West and Cindy Sheehan. Right now, I'm on the board, the steering committee, along with several Native American activists here in Minnesota, Nicole Bolio and Curtis Bakanaga. Cindy Sheehan is on the steering committee. Cornel West is no longer on it, I guess, because he decided to support Obama. And it's our position that, you know, there should be no support for politicians like Obama and these Democrats that have really betrayed the American people on issues of war and peace and on the economy and civil rights. And so he's no longer on the board.
How long has the New Progressive Alliance been in existence?
I think it was 2010. Somewhere around 2010, I think it came into existence.
So it's been around for 2 years?
The way it came into existence was a discussion that was taking place on a website called Fire Dog Lake. And people were discussing who should be the candidates and stuff that might challenge Obama in the Democratic Party primary. That was really the way that, you know, our organization came about, through that discussion.
Very interesting when you look at what was taking place in 2008 and also in 2010. And people, 3 years ago, they were already looking forward to the elections taking place in 2012 and looking for people that would be able to challenge Barack Obama on the left. And obviously Barack Obama received an overwhelming amount of support during the election of 2012. But
right.
When you consider much of what Barack Obama has done over the years as a disappointment to many people that identify with many of the left causes, Why do you think so many, the vast majority or millions, including many people on the left, why did they still go and run after, go to the polls and support Barack Obama in 2012?
Well, with the left, I think the problem has been that we had a group of people associated, they called themselves the Progressives for Obama. They now call themselves Progressive America Rising. And this was a group headed up by Tom Hayden and several other people, Barbara Ehrenreich and Carl Davidson, and some people who say that they're spokespersons for the left. And they actually, what happened is the way this organization did, they brought Obama in to speak at a big peace demonstration that was held in Chicago. I think that was in right around 2008, maybe it was 2007 or something. Anyways, Obama didn't say much at the demonstration. There were a lot of people that didn't even want him to talk because they didn't believe that he was for peace. And anyways, this gave Obama the credibility to be a candidate of peace, you might say. And if you look at the webpage still today, you see Obama speaking at this rally. And since then, you know, we all know that Obama isn't a man of peace. In fact, back when they were promoting Obama, I actually sent around an article that Obama had written, I believe it was in the summer of 2007, talking about how the United States has to regain the leadership in the world. And it was an outright, call to an imperialist policy, a Wall Street policy. It was published in the Council on Foreign Relations magazine, Foreign Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And when I sent this article, the actual article, I didn't even send it with any commentary other than asking, is this progressive? And I sent it out to about 28,000 progressives across the country from mailing lists and stuff from all these organizations, peace organizations and everything. And people like Tom Hayden and Carl Davidson started calling me names just because I sent this out. And, you know, I didn't really know what to make of it at the time, and a lot of other people didn't either. They were all wondering, well, here's Obama speaking all over. He spoke to a group before the AFL-CIO in Chicago and said that he was for single-payer universal health care. He said that, you know, the war in Iraq was a stupid war. And people were buying into all this, and that they created an image. They gave Obama an image of being progressive when he didn't deserve that image at all, and it's caused massive confusion on the left. That's my opinion. And, you know, you even had the Communist Party leadership is solidly supporting Obama, providing him all kinds of cover with all kinds of lies about what they say Obama is when they know, in fact, that he isn't. And, you know, I think that's terrible. The Communist Party lost thousands of members over this.
Oh, why is it that the Communist Party that they would support and have supported, given support to Obama over the years, what is with that, you know, it's not, I don't even see it being, when I look over the long, in the past, being the nature of the party, what is with that?
Well, what actually happened is the present leaders of the Communist Party received very large contributions from some foundation-funded outfits, and they got connected up with the Century Foundation, and they received like $2 million to remodel their national headquarters and everything. And this is where all that started. They started getting money from them back in 2000. And once these foundation outfits took over the Communist Party, it was no longer an anti-imperialist organization or a class-conscious organization that participates in working-class struggles. I mean, you can read the Communist Party newspaper, The People's World, and see that. But it wasn't just the Communist Party. There's a number of other left-wing organizations that have done the same thing. And it's confused working people. I mean, quite frankly, if the left isn't united with an anti-imperialist agenda and an anti-Wall Street agenda, I mean, Wall Street is our enemy. Wall Street is not our friend.
No.
Barack Obama speaks for Wall Street, so how can Barack Obama be the friend of working people? I mean, it's pretty
much as
simple as
that. He's the chief representative for Wall Street.
Sure. And when left organizations start to give support to that kind of political ideology and policy, I mean, it confuses working people. The same thing sort of happened back around World War II in the socialist movement, international socialist movement. There were some socialists that supported the imperialist wars and other socialist organizations that opposed the imperialist wars. And that created a lot of confusion in the working class movement. And there's, now, there's been this whole thing about, what do you call it, pragmatism that's developed in this country where people say, well, you got to sort of overlook all these wars and everything that Obama's engaged in if he does some things good for people, you know, here in this country. And then they point to things like Obamacare and student loans. But, you know, if you even look at Obamacare, what is it? That's nothing but the health insurance and pharmaceutical industry bailout and profit maximization act. That's all that it is. And
right.
if you look at student loans, what has Obama done there? To me, this is really terrible because you have the Xerox Corporation that bought out this, they call it ACS. It's a collection agency, and this collection agency has set up call centers in Jamaica and other places where they're hiring people for 50 cents an hour and even less to collect on these student loans. And Xerox is actually getting anywhere from 40 to 60% of what they collect off of these student loans. So instead of giving students a break on their loans and saying, hey, you know, we'll forgive you so much money, they're allowing Xerox to profit from these student loans and all this student debt. This is terrible. You know, and then these Obama people and some people on the left say Obama has helped students, that Obama has helped. You know, people with health care, none of that is true.
No, none of it's true. What type of support is, and we're going to get into many of the points that you have in the platform for the New Progressive Alliance, but who are some of the players? Who are, I noticed on the website it says 54 candidates during the elections or during the 2012 election had endorsed or supported the New Progressive Alliance, and you have obviously other organizations, but who are those that have actually come out within the last 6 months to a year that have supported or given their support to the New Progressive Alliance?
Well, are you talking about the New Progressive Alliance?
Presidential candidates, people, individuals that were running as U.S. Senate candidates during the last election. Who are some of those players? Jill Stein, did she come out and endorse and support the platform for the party?
Yeah, Jill Stein supported the United Progressive Platform. You supported it with some,
right.
I mean, you stated some things that, you know, and I agree with what you stated, where some things weren't actually, left-wing enough, you might say. But then Rocky Anderson supported it, and he had some
Rocky.
Reservations, too. But
what about Gary Johnson?
About 50, what?
Did Gary Johnson support it?
I don't think he did, not that I know of. I don't think we would have taken his. I would have been opposed to taking his support. I don't think that the Libertarians offer any kind of progressive agenda at all. I think that they offer a right-wing, very right-wing agenda.
Right, it's very right-wing. So basically, you had 54 candidates. I should know this.
They were Green Party candidates.
Did Greg Payson, I should be asking Greg Payson this, because he's in the Socialist Party USA, was he one of those that endorsed the platform?
It's been a while since I saw the list.
Okay. Well, it's quite a few. As I mentioned, it's 54 candidates that have supported it. And in addition to that, it was other organizations that have supported it as well. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to get into various elements of the platform. And what is your exact position, or what position do you hold within the New Progressive Alliance?
I'm just a member of the steering committee. And
the
steering committee, well, we can go through it right here. The steering committee consists of Paul Barrow, Nicole Bolio, Curtis Buchanaga, Cian Jasmine, myself, Cindy Sheehan, Dr. Jill Stein. I guess she's back on the steering committee. She had been off of it for a while she campaigned.
Mm-hmm.
David Swanson and Richard Winger and Kevin Zeese, with Anthony Noel as a facilitator. So it's a very diverse group of people, and we've had a lot of people come around helping to do different things, like contacting various candidates, and right now we're trying to set up liaisons with people from each state to actually build to sort of fill in the skeleton of what we have of an organization right now to make it so that we can influence, you know, things in the future as we go along. Because the thing that we really want to promote at this point is an alternative political party to the Republicans and the Democrats. And mm-hmm. what we're hoping to see is a number of people from everyone from liberals to progressives to leftists come together and see if we can get behind a candidate that's going to support the United Progressive Platform. And I don't know if we can do that. It's been hard to get the left to do things together. But that's sort of our goal. And like I said on your program before, I don't know how we're going to do it if we don't do this because of the resources involved in just trying to get ballot access and everything across the country. You know, they talk about a democracy, but it's almost impossible for progressives to get on the ballot as an alternative political party in most states in this country. The Green Party, I guess, hired people to go around collecting signatures, which cost a lot of money. And we don't think that, you know, we should have to, you know, pay people to go out and collect signatures, that there should be enough support for a new political movement so that, you know, we can get volunteers to go out and do this. And when you look at the people in this country, how fed up they are and everything, it's a matter of, I think people want to see people begin to work together towards common goals and objectives. And once they see people are working like that, they'll join these, you know, the movements to accomplish this. But so far, it's been real hard to do that.
How does it look for the left going forward, moving toward 2016? Individuals have asked, would I start a campaign toward 2016? And at this point, I have absolutely no interest in that. But how does it look for candidates or parties or for the left going into 2016? Because surely I think any campaign should have started 3 weeks ago. But how does it look for third parties moving forward?
Well, the Justice Party is holding a convention, I guess, in I think Seattle, Washington, sometimes in February. That's with Rocky Anderson. And I think that offers some pretty good potential. And then you still have the Green Party. The Green Party is probably the largest party in this country that offers an alternative to the Democrats and Republicans. But at the same time, I think that the Green Party doesn't really have the kind of base that's going to support an alternative party like, say, the party of the New Democratic Party in Canada. Mm-hmm. And it's the position of the of our organization, the New Progressive Alliance, that what this country needs is a political party that's very similar to the New Democratic Party in Canada. And that's not, you know, there's a lot of people that say, well, Canadian politics is different than American politics, which is true.
Yeah,
I've been in Canada for 10 years, so I know that it's different. But what people don't understand, see, we've been robbed of our history in this country. What people don't understand is that the New Democratic Party in Canada actually had its birth within the Minnesota Farmer Labor Party, the old socialist Minnesota Farmer Labor Party. A group of Canadians came down and met with Floyd Olson, who was the governor at the time, and Elmer Benson, who worked for Olson, later to become the socialist governor in Minnesota. And they met with a group of Canadians, and the Canadians went back to Canada, and they actually formed committees for a Farmer Labor Party in Canada, and that became the basis for the what eventually became the New Democratic Party in Canada. So, you know, it's not like it's the New Democratic Party in Canada is just a Canadian formation. It isn't. It had its roots right here in Minnesota. And what people don't understand, because they've been robbed of their history, here in Minnesota, back in the 1930s, we had two socialist governors, Floyd Olson and Elmer Benson. We had a communist elected on the Farmer Labor Party ticket, who was John Bernard, the guy that cast his vote, the lone vote, against the embargo of arms in Spain. So, you know, and almost every single city council in the state was dominated by socialists in the Farmer Labor Party. Boards of education, township boards, county commissions. The Farmer Labor Party was dominant, had the majority in the Minnesota State House, and almost achieved the majority in the Minnesota State Senate. So it's not like this was an insignificant little movement that was going here in Minnesota. And they had made plans to take the Farmer Labor Party national in 1938, mm-hmm. but Floyd Olson and between the time that they made the decision to try and take it national and the time that they were going to hold the convention, Floyd Olson died of cancer. He was going to be the candidate of the Farmer Labor Party against Roosevelt because they felt that Roosevelt wasn't pushing reforms far enough and fast enough. So, and Roosevelt was real, people don't understand this, Roosevelt was real concerned that Floyd Olson was going to take enough votes away from him so that a Republican might win. So they, Floyd Olson actually got up off of his deathbed at the invitation of Francis Perkins, who was Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor, and met with Roosevelt over the issue of health care. You know, and at that time, Floyd Olson was pushing the idea that we needed what was needed was a national public health care system, and Francis Perkins agreed with that. And, we're getting this whole new history from Oliver Stone, and he's beginning to deal with some of these issues like Henry Wallace and the fight with Truman and everything. And people are beginning to get a whole new look now at what politics was really like in this country, what the whole history that they've been robbed of. From Oliver Stone's new version of history that's, telling the facts and telling it the way it is. This Henry Wallace, he had massive support among the American people. He filled football stadiums and baseball stadiums with his supporters, and they actually paid big money for tickets to come and participate in his campaign at these functions. These weren't free or anything. This is the way they raised money to support the Progressive Party. So I think we have to start looking at all these things to see, you know, how we can build on the progressive foundation that we have in this country. And we have a lot of history to build on. There was the La Follette elections in Wisconsin. You had socialists being elected to the legislatures in North Dakota, all over the Midwest, and out west in Kansas and Nebraska. So, you know, there is that history, but people have been robbed of that history, so we haven't been able to build on those movements. And that's what we got to start to do, in my opinion.
Alan, does the new Progressive Alliance, do they have a membership base? I mean, what is the membership within the organization? I know they have people that have endorsed and support
the platform
party. So far, it's
just been more or less volunteers that have come around to help. There's no dues-paying membership or anything. Anybody that wants to come and help do anything that we've got to do or has an idea, they're invited to come and participate. It's been a very loose-knit organization. I think probably that's been maybe the success of the organization. It's not our intent to start a new political party, but we want to create the discourse in this country where people begin to talk about an alternative political party to the point where it becomes a reality. Your campaign and the Green Party campaign and the Justice Party campaign in the last election, I mean, there's never been such an interest in independent political movements as what the three of you have generated, and that's got to be built on, you know. We can't just let it
there
go.
And I agree with you. There was extreme interest in all the campaigns, especially I was surprised all the many of the comments, many of the supporters that were out there for the Alexander Mendoza campaign, especially over the last year. What was somewhat disappointing was it was a lot of support that was generated outside of the organization. When I say outside of the organization, outside of the Socialist Party USA. But again, it's that where you don't have we don't have the type of organization that we need within our groups, our organizations, because that was what was strongly needed for the Alexander Mendoza campaign, for us to have like a coherent agenda within the party where we could have been able to organize in many of the states where we had locals and chapters, and that didn't happen.
Alan,
what I would like you to do, I would like for you to take another minute and a half. Today we have Alan Mackey. He's on the program today. He was on a couple of weeks ago sharing information about the new Progressive Alliance and also what he is doing to support many of the left parties, left organizations throughout the country. And he has a rich background as far as activism. Alan, could you just take a minute or so and just reintroduce yourself? Thank you.
Sure. I've been involved in movements going back many years, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the civil rights movement. The high school I went to, we were involved in a whole federal court action to get the school integrated. And I've been involved in the labor movement most of my life, for well over 30 years, doing research and writing and organizing. So, you know, it's been my life. And it's been my life a lot because I was blacklisted as a worker. And I was blacklisted as a worker, and then I was blacklisted by the union. So, you know, that's one thing that people got to start to consider in this country. I know that there was I just was reading a review of a book I forgot the woman's name. I think it was Jane something. She wrote a book about her life as an organizer, and she talked about how when the communists and socialists were kicked out of the unions, that's when the unions began to slide backwards. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And if we look from 1947 till now, you know, the industrial unions were built by socialists and communists as their core. And after they were kicked out of the unions in 1947 and 1948, 1950, the trade union movement began to weaken and deteriorate to the point where it can't even defend the rights of workers in this country anymore. You know, it's hard for a worker to even get their own unions to back and support their grievances, just like right. The normal grievance in the workplace. They get thrown in a pile and they're taken care of at contract time, and usually they're not even resolved. The only resolution is that they agree to do nothing about the grievances.
Very, very interesting, Alan, when you say grievances. Years ago, I remember you could go to unions, and I've been a member of several unions over the years, including the Teamsters Machinist Union, Retail Clerks. But years ago, where you could go to your union and you presented your grievance, and you had your representative would come there, and they would look into whatever those matters. And then companies years ago, then they would say, present, you know, we have this this box where if you have some concerns about the work conditions or whatever, put your concerns in that box. They should have said, please don't put your name on the grievance,
yeah.
Because you're probably going to be earmarked for termination. And then those boxes, they disappeared. They were usually little shoe boxes that people would just stick their grievances in. And now most people in most businesses, they don't have a process for presenting grievances. And with many of the right-to-work states, if you have any grievances, the only thing they do is just get rid of you. But
yeah, exactly.
And you're working on various actions within your state and also within that area of the country to address affirmative action, and also where we can be able to have better representation for employees. Could you share a little bit about that, what you're doing in regards to affirmative action, Alan?
Sure. Right now here in the state of Minnesota, we've got two huge projects, public works projects, in the works. The Viking Stadium, which is a $1 billion construction project, $1 billion plus, and a bridge spanning the St. Croix River from Minnesota to Wisconsin, which is another $1 billion plus project. And the governor is trying to evade affirmative action by saying he's established a committee for what he calls equity. And what this means is that there will be token hiring of minority people and women. We're insisting that an affirmative action committee be put in place by the governor so that there's a study that would be done to determine what kind of unemployment exists among communities of people of color and women, and that the hiring should take place on the basis of those studies. That's what affirmative action is all about. And so we presented this. In fact, I was asked to write the letter by a group of people that came together in Minneapolis. I think it's been over a year ago now. Anyways, I drafted that letter, and it was approved by the people at the meeting, and it was sent to the governor. And the governor hasn't even had the decency to reply, even though it was his the leading member of his legal staff, Micah Hines, who asked me to write the letter and get the letter to the governor. And we haven't even had a response to that. And we just asked for a very simple thing, and that's that the governor enforce the intent federal executive order 11246, which is the affirmative action legislation that Lyndon Johnson signed way back in 1964 or 1965. Hubert Humphrey was standing right next to him, and Martin Luther King was there. And what we find amazing here in Minnesota is that Hubert Humphrey would always make a big deal about problems of racism in Mississippi, but affirmative action has never been enforced here in the state of Minnesota, even though for much of the time since 1964, Democrats have had a major say in the politics of this state. Even Hubert Humphrey never insisted that affirmative action be enforced. And Walter Mondale never insisted that affirmative action be enforced here in Minnesota. So, you know, we have a disgraceful employment situation where on Indian reservations here in Minnesota, you have an official unemployment rate anywhere from 65% as the low to 85% as the high, which is breeding poverty. I mean, massive poverty. That's just like any third world poverty. And that's right here in Minnesota, among thousands of Native American people are living in this poverty because they can't get access to the jobs that their own taxes go to pay for. The taxes of minority people are going to pay for the Viking Stadium just like everybody else's taxes, or the bridge that's going across the river. And yet people aren't getting access to the jobs the way the law says that they're supposed to. You know, they talk about a nation of laws, but these politicians are choosing not to enforce affirmative action because they're afraid of losing the votes, the racist votes from the suburbs. So affirmative action isn't being dealt with.
And Alan, what I see taking place is a lot of it is all about complacency, and we've become a nation of just complacent people. And also, as we see with the job situation, many people just dropping out of the system. When I look at it, when you look at various persons that are being discriminated against and people that are not finding or have lost their position in the workplace, a lot of it has to do with just based on race. Females, you see a lot of females, they can't find a job, and subsequently they drop out of the system so they can just take care of, one of the parents. It could be male or the female, and one person is working and the other one is not. And the other thing is age. We have many individuals that are over 45, over 50 years old. If they're without a job, chances are very slim and none that they will be able to find a job in this work environment. And again, this is affirmative action. We need it more than ever today, and we don't. But again, as I mentioned, we have a complacent nation where people are making excuses instead of demanding from their leadership jobs, especially in the, as I mentioned, minority communities with blacks, and especially when you look at within families. So this is a very serious problem that we need to address. And I see what you're doing. I appreciate it that you are right on the front lines when it comes to that issue.
Yeah, one of the things that we found is I don't know really how much complacency plays a part in this and how much people are being deceived, because what we see is a lot of these foundation-funded outfits are coming forward and saying they're agreeing to token hiring. In other words, that they will say, let us train so many people. So they might, like on a job like the Viking Stadium, they're talking maybe training 100 people, minority people, to do some of the jobs. We're talking about a public works project that's going to employ 7,500 people. And yet,
right,
you know, the governor will hold up saying that, I'm working with these foundations and we're training 100 or 150 or 200 people. That is not affirmative action.
No.
And so when people see this and they see the statements by a governor saying, oh, yes, I'm trying to do something about this, they actually believe them, you know. And I think that people are going to have to start questioning these politicians, because it's not that, it's really that they're just plain outrightly lying. And the reason they lie when it comes to affirmative action is because there's so much profits to be made in racism in this country.
Right.
When they can create these huge pools of unemployed people in urban areas, on Indian reservations. These large pools of unemployed people are used just like a policeman's billy club over the heads of other workers. So that if they start asking for more money, all they have to say is, hey, if you don't want to work, you know, we got all these people out here that'll gladly do your job. And that's, we've seen that here in Minnesota with the lockout of 1,300 people at American Crystal Sugar Company in the, here in the Red River Valley. The company literally locked 1,300 workers out of these plants, sugar-producing plants, and they hired a bunch of scabs to do the work. And the company boasts, if you people don't want to work, look at all these people we can hire. And they are. Right. They've got their entire operation running, and you got 1,300 people that have been out of work for over a year because the company locked them out. And we're going to see the companies use those tactics more and more. And we've seen it in the construction industry where they've gotten away from contracts and they have these so-called project management agreements. And every time you start to look at these project management agreements, the terms of the agreements are less and less for the workers. And the reason for that is because everybody's afraid that there's somebody else that'll come and take their job if they stand up for their rights and their livelihoods. And that's what's happening in this country. People are afraid.
They are.
So it's not just all complacency. And then the other thing is repression. My good friend who led the movement for affirmative action on the Bemidji Regional Event Center, a $60 million public works project here in northern Minnesota, the FBI hounded him, and they hounded him and created charge after charge against him until the guy committed suicide. And this is a Native American worker who was in the Building and Construction Trades Union that tried to get Native Americans jobs on this public works project, and they made his life a living hell. I mean, literally, day after day after day, you had the FBI, because the FBI is supposedly the law enforcement on these Indian reservations. The FBI was hounding this guy. They were constantly taking pictures of him. They were harassing the people that came to his home to discuss this issue, you know, and they made his life such a living hell, he ended up committing suicide. And now you've got another case out in the state of Washington, Melina Harris. She faces a major felony jail time. Her only crime is fighting for the rights of women to get access to jobs in the construction industry. And the police attacked her. They beat the crap out of her. They beat her unconscious. And now she's being charged with a felony for assaulting a police officer up there in the state of Washington. You know,
so she got beat, and she's being charged.
Yeah, she's been convicted. And her sentencing is going to be this week. And a judge wants to put her in jail, and she was the one that was beat up by the cops.
Oh, God.
So, you know, there's major repression taking place in this country. I was arrested myself several weeks ago on a 21-year-old warrant.
Right. 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, and it was
the
for
charge
supposedly
was
used the telephone to harass some right wingers. And the thing of it is, I never even made the calls. There was a bogus charge to start with. They never even tried to serve the warrants on me, but yet they bring them up over 20 years later because they want to take me out of a casino where I'm talking to casino workers about organizing a union in Gun Lake. So the judge sets a $10,000 bond on me for a charge that only carries, at a maximum, $500 fine and 6 months in jail. You know, they literally treated me like I was some kind of bank robber or a big drug dealer or something.
Wow.
And so, you know, this is the kind of political persecution and repression that's taking place against working-class activists all over this country, and we're seeing it more and more. You see people from Occupy Wall Street to where they were hounded and harassed by the police. And
many of them are still going to court
to talk with the people in Gaza. They get harassed to no end. I know people in here in Minnesota that have been harassed. Their lives have been made a living hell just because they tried to get supplies into the people of Gaza.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're not charged
with
any crimes or anything, but the FBI goes and talks to their neighbors and tell them that they're dangerous people and everything else. This, you know, this is why people are leery about speaking out.
Right, and what it is doing is we're giving up all of our constitutional rights. Basically, the Constitution in this country is just being reduced down to just a draft document. but nothing more than that.
Right.
Alan, what I would like to do is just take another minute just to reintroduce yourself, and I am going to get into the areas of the platform for the new Progressive Alliance. I've been trying to do that, but it's been a very interesting talk with you thus far. Just take a minute, and then we're going to get into the 10 points of your other platform, okay?
Sure. Well, like I said, I've just been involved in movements all my life, working class struggles, peace movement, the civil rights movement. And I think it's important that everybody, you know, all working people become involved, because if working people aren't involved in trying to solve their own problems, the people in power aren't going to do anything for us.
And, Alan, as I mentioned, I want to get into your platform, and the first
sure.
thing that you have on the platform is you say peace first. And, of course, this is something that we see that, you know, is been very elusive here in the 21st century, starting with right at the almost at the beginning of the term for President Bush, and as we move forward through the term, the second term, going into the second term of President Barack Obama, it seemed like that peace is just so far away from being from even happening within the next decade or within the next few years. What is the position of the new Progressive Alliance in regards to what we need to do to move toward a peaceful agenda within that organization?
Well, we say peace first, because if you look at the way the economy is and everything in this country, essentially what we're saying is that these wars are making us all poor. And a country, any country, you know, a big country like the United States, spending, you know, billions and trillions of dollars on these wars, it's only a common sense that when a country spends this kind of money on wars, on bombs and bullets killing people in other countries, that money is not available to spend here in this country for things like education and health care, to fill the potholes in the streets or build bridges or anything else that people need. So we say that, you know, we got to start talking about peace, because these wars and militarism are robbing us of the wealth that working people in this country have produced. And that's what we're talking about, the wealth of this country. And we don't think that these warmongers in power, though, the Wall Street merchants of death and destruction, should be allowed to continue to squander our wealth and resources on these wars. Wars that never should be fought in the first place, because all they are doing is defending Wall Street's interests all over the world. You know, we have 800 military bases around the world. And what are these military bases doing? They're protecting Wall Street's interests.
Right.
What are our Wall Street's interests? Cheap labor to attain cheap natural resources, and cheap labor for manufacturing, which is taking jobs away from people in this country and sending them overseas to these cheap labor areas. And these people, the people overseas, they're rebelling against this exploitation and the rape of their land. So these bases are placed in their countries to, you know, assure Wall Street of a cheap labor market and cheap natural resources and cheap production. And
now, are you calling for is the New Progressive Alliance, are they calling for closing all military bases outside of the U.S. or closing many of the U.S. bases that are within this country?
Well, I don't think we have a position on the bases really in this country, but we are for closing all 800 military bases around the world. And we're for ending this, they call it leapfrog, where the United States military now, instead of placing bases like in countries like the Philippines, where the people have kicked the U.S. military out, essentially, the U.S. military has all these rapid deployment forces that they send in. Right now there's thousands of U.S. troops in the Philippines, and the bases have supposedly been closed, but then these troops go in and they set up their little camps and stuff in the mountains and stuff to put down the people's rebellions there in that country. The Philippines is a perfect example of, you know, why we need peace first in this country. The Philippines were part of the Spanish-American War, the first imperialist war that this country ever fought, and we're still fighting in that country over 100 years later. And I asked my Congressman Colin Peterson how much it's cost to maintain the Philippines as a colony and to rule over it and to maintain control of it for these past 100 years. And he told me that I was nuts for asking that question. But I think those are the kind of questions people have a right to
right.
have an answer to. I mean, these people are in power, are waging these wars, and they don't want us to know the real cost of these wars or anything. How many people think in terms of this, that we're still paying for the Spanish-American War, you know? And we're in the same terms, we're going to be paying for the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan for probably well over 100 years.
Well over 100 years.
We're successful in kicking us out, you know? And we have the same thing in Korea. The people of Korea want unification, and yet we've got a huge military presence that we're paying for in South Korea, and we're even paying to build a new naval base that the people don't want on an island, a beautiful little island in South Korea. So, you know, all this squandering of our wealth, it's just not throwing money away. It means that we don't have money to spend here in this country. We have billions of dollars going to the Israeli killing machine to carry out this horrendous carnage against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Right.
And, you know, at the same time, we have members of Congress saying we've got to cut budgets. You know, they even want to cut Social Security. They want to cut Social Security because they borrowed money from the Social Security Fund in order to pay for these wars, and they don't want to have to pay that money back is what it amounts to. That's why there's a question about Social Security in this country right now. So you've got all these things that relate to peace in this country, and we can't solve our problems unless we have a peace-first policy, foreign policy in this country, where we got to learn to live with the rest of the world and not order the rest of the world around and think we can steal everything that they have.
And what is the position of the NPA in regards to cutting all the funding to Israel?
Well, we think the funding should be cut off completely. The Israel has shown that they're not worthy of sinking another penny into that government. So, you know, we're for the boycotts and everything, the divestment. People
right.
from the New Progressive Alliance here in Minnesota pushed hard for a resolution, even within the Democratic Party, calling for disinvestment from Israel. So, you know, we're doing things like that. And we had a candidate, Michael Cavlin, that ran for the United States Senate, and he made a major issue. He was supported by the New Progressive Alliance, and he supported the United Progressive Platform. And he traveled across Minnesota talking to people about divestment of state monies from Israel. People don't know it, but a lot of the colleges and universities, they all got their money, and a lot of them have, you know, major investments in the state of Israel and the corporations and everything there, and he went around calling for disinvestment and boycotts of Israeli products and everything. But, you know, these are some of the things that MPA members are doing, you know, on a local level and a statewide level. And Mike Cavlin was pushing very hard for you know, a new political party on the Open Progressive Party, he called it, but he was working also with Rocky Anderson and the Justice Party. And myself, I was, you know, I was pushing hard for the Socialist Party. You need to be on the ballot here in Minnesota. So I think, you know, I think socialism is a system that promotes peace and social justice, and I think we got to put that out there on the table. As part of, and this isn't the NPA position, but it's my personal position.
Yeah.
I think we've got socialism out there on the table for people to begin to consider, because capitalism is a system of war. I mean, we're in the highest stage of capitalism and imperialism, and it's not going to do anything but breed war after war after war. We've seen that it's going to be perpetual
endless wars.
Yeah, and the only thing we can do to stop that, in my opinion, is to place socialism on the table as a system of peace that the American people begin to consider.
Alan, the next thing you have on the agenda here says full employment at a living wage. And of course, I'm
right.
very supportive of that. But let me ask you, when you say full employment is possible at a living wage. A lot of people tell me, well, that's unreasonable. Is that possible? In your
opinion, it is possible and it is reasonable. And when we talk about a living wage, let me explain this. We think the minimum wage should be tied to all cost of living factors. That's the only reasonable way to eliminate poverty in this country. Now, if that's a problem for these corporate people and the business community to have a living wage that's relating and tied to the cost of living factors, then we can do these people a favor. We can create universal social programs, like if we have decent housing available at low cost, subsidized by the government. If we have a national public health care system where people get free health care, if we have a national public child care system where people get free child care, we can create all kinds of programs like this, and then you won't need a living wage, a minimum wage that is so high that these business people object to it. But, you know, unless we have universal social programs that in some way cut down on these cost of living factors, then these employers are going to have to pay a real living wage tied to all cost of living factors. I mean, it's as simple as that. If these people don't like it, let them hire their wives or children or stuff to try and do the work that they want done. Mm-hmm. And that's been the position that the Canadian Labor Congress has taken. If you don't want to pay working people a real living wage to do the job that you need to have done, then let your wife and your children go and do those jobs and see how far you get. But, you know, we've got a situation in this country where the profits that are being generated are just tremendous, and there's no reason why every single worker in this country should work for any less than a minimum wage. And as far as full employment, we could easily have full employment, but we're not going to get full employment if we leave it to the private sector. We've seen the private sector has failed miserably, and we can't expect the private sector to provide people with jobs. The only way we're going to get people back to work in this country is to create jobs with putting people to work, solving the problems of the people. That means setting up a national public health care system, a national public child care system. A national public health care system would create 12 to 15 million new jobs in this country while providing people with free health care. How does that compare to Obamacare? You know, mm-hmm. We need child care in this country. Ask right. any working family what they need. And a young family will tell you, we need help in child care. Well, why shouldn't child care be part of the public education system in this country? You know, every single elementary school could have a child care center connected to it. You know, that's simple. Other countries in the world do it. There's nothing hard or complicated to figure out how to solve that problem. And
I noticed you mentioned also when you have, in that same section where you have for full employment, a universal basic income, federal guaranteed livable income.
Right.
Is the public, do you think working people are ready for this? I found a lot of opposition to that over the years that I've been campaigning, that I was campaigning. But is the public ready for that? And can you explain what you're referring to when you say a universal basic income, so our listeners can understand?
Well, what we mean when we're saying we need that kind of income in this country for people is that if people aren't going to have a job, then welfare and unemployment compensation have to be tied to the cost of living factors too. Social Security should be tied to the cost of living factors. There's no reason why people should have to live in poverty in this country. And, you know, all people say, well, where's that money going to come from? Well, again,
right.
That was the next question
I was going to ask.
Take it from stop these wars and close all these military bases down, and we'll have plenty of money. If there isn't enough money when we do that, then tax the hell out of the rich until we come up with the funds to do these kinds of things. There's no reason why the wealthy shouldn't be taxed in this country and why corporations shouldn't be taxed to the hilt. After all, it's working people that are creating all this wealth, and to have a small group of people now controlling this wealth is just, it's immoral, it's just totally immoral while so many people are living in poverty in this country. Just walk through any Indian reservation in this country and you can see how people are living the poverty. Walk through any urban area in this country, and you see the poverty. People are losing their homes left and right because they can't afford the mortgage payments. well, there's something drastically wrong when a government can't do anything to solve these kinds of problems. You have to begin to ask, if the government can't solve these basic problems for people, what can this government do? And it can't do much except for help the very wealthy in Wall Street. So this is why we say we need a new party to challenge all this. We don't have any illusions that the Democrats and Republicans are going to develop these kind of programs. You know, it didn't happen in the 1930s that way. Even people are mistaken if they think that Roosevelt and the Democrats gave people anything, because they didn't. Everything people got in the 1930s, from Social Security to unemployment compensation to the WPA to the CCC programs, all of this was fought for by people in the streets. And people are going to have to fight for that again. Part of the discourse in this country is going to have to be, if people don't support these kinds of things, the left is going to have to raise these issues in a way that people begin to discuss them. Because one reason why they don't have support is because there's been no discussion. Right. Day after day, people are bombarded with this whole notion that private industry and the private sector is going to cure all of our problems. Well, at some point, we got to introduce something into this discourse in this country where we say this is not going to happen, and what is needed is, massive social programs, massive government programs. There's a lot of people that say the government already has their hands in too much. Well, you know, I don't think that that's the case at all. Government isn't doing enough. We need massive government programs if we're going to solve the unemployment question.
Right.
It's as simple as that.
Right. The last thing, because we've only gotten into two areas, and we're going to have you back on as a guest again to discuss many of these other areas of your platform. I really find it's very incredible how much of it I identify with, and how much of it is I can identify with the Alexander Mendoza platform that we had when we were running in the campaign for 2012. Just very briefly, and then we're going to we have around 2 minutes here. You said a social safety net. What do we need to do? I mean, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that's a pretty big area. And obviously it's going to cost to protect and to provide a social safety net. We're talking about trillions of dollars.
Well, one thing real quick about Social Security, Stuart. A lot is being made of Social Security being in trouble. But there is only one solution as far as keeping Social Security solvent, and that's full employment. When you got everybody to work in this country, everybody will be paying Social Security taxes. And I've never heard one single worker kick about having to pay Social Security taxes compared to what they get out of it. And the trick to this is putting this country on a foundation where we have full employment in this country, and that will take care of any Social Security problem. And it will allow us to actually increase benefits in the Social Security program and move the Social Security program to where it should be, into new areas, too. So,
well,
you know,
Alan, a very amazing organization, the New Progressive Alliance, and you had mentioned that you'll be willing to come on and discuss what the organization is about, your platform, and we look forward to having you to come back on within the next few weeks to get into more detail about that. I think, and I have to just let you know that I believe that you're making a real difference here in the U.S. and also on the left, and I would like to just commend the support that you've been giving to much of the leadership on the left. Alan, how can people reach you?
They can call me at 218-386-2432. My email address is amackey, that's A-M-A-K-I, 000, at centurytel.net. Or they can just Google my name, and you'll come across my blog, the Podunk blog, and that has my contact information on it. They can do the same thing with the New Progressive Alliance. Just Google New Progressive Alliance, and you can come to our website. We also have a Facebook page, and I have a Facebook page. So thanks for having me, Stuart, and I look forward to being on your program anytime.
Thanks again, Alan, and we look forward to having all of our listeners to join us next week, the same time. Thanks again, and thank you, Alan. Thank you, Ruth Ann. Have a good night.
Hello, are we on?
Okay, well, I have to ask, 784, can you hear us? We seem to be having, you can, okay, good. Yes, you're on. Sorry, there was a little problem there. Okay.
Okay, so we ready to start? Or, didn't know
yep.
if there was,
no, go for it.
We had intro music or something of that.
Just edit, write down, so, yeah.
Okay, okay, and so you said 784. I keep hearing unmuted, so, you know, make sure that I'm still.
Yeah, maybe I was thinking, this is Mark. That's
okay. 784. All right, so let me go ahead and open the discussion, and then I was made aware over the weekend that there were games afoot, as we would say. Everyone is concerned about Palestine and Israel and Iran. And for months, there's been, you know, growing suspicion among some of us that there were other games afoot. And we saw some of that during Hurricane Sandy. The ability to turn a crisis into a political stepping stone, as Secretary of State, former Senator Clinton, made the statement to not let a perfectly good crisis go to waste. So it's become part of the political fabric to send in, as it were, the FEMA, National Guard, military troops, and set up a, military type maneuver operations. Well, guess where that activity just showed up? Some of the people that were looking at Benghazi started using the term fast and furious in relation to, what was going on with a group called AFRICOM, is African Command, or you might say African Commandos. But the target appears to be the swampland in Central Africa that has gone from the name Congo to Zaire, and now it's gone back to, the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo. Now, Ruthann, are you able to look something up online? I didn't get a chance to. After they shut down the computers at the library, I went and looked up. There was actually an article in the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
Related to the rebel group that had come over from Rwanda, which is a neighbor of the DR Congo.
Right.
Okay, and Rwanda was being cut off by the UK for, several millions of dollars or pounds in foreign aid. I love all these little names that they have for, for slush funds and protection racket, drug money, drugs and guns. They used to say guns and butter. But this, this activity in the Congo, and by the way, I typed in nuclear Congo on the video site, which I don't like to give them free advertising. So we'll just say the video site. And the only thing that I found related to the 16 nuclear reactors, power plants that have been built in the Congo, along the Congo River, Congolese River, I guess it is, So I set up a discussion group called Fracking the DR Congo, or Fracking the DR Congo. And, you know, on the, we call it the Frack Book, you know, or FB for short. And this activity in the Congo points to another false flag intervention, except this time it appears that they're prepared to kick the Chinese and Indians out of Africa with another Islamic front.
Hmm.
You know, so to the public, it looks like a war between Christians and Muslims.
Well, that's the way they want it to look.
Exactly. It's got to look like another accident of nature, you know, just like all of these freak storms. And then Mark was telling me that there's, you know, storm activity in the Philippines, you know, a typhoon in December.
Right. I saw something about that, too.
Okay, so, you know, we're kept pretty busy, you know, discussing, you know, what these global interventionists are plotting, you know, with their new weapons, the weapon altering toys. What was we using WFP for weather, weather weapons of mass destruction, or weather for a mass distraction. And, you know, it went from Iran to Palestine, and then back to Syria, and then back to Palestine. And so it looked like it was going to just get, you know, more and more of an escalation. And then peace broke out. Right? You know, so everybody is celebrating, you know, Palestinian, you know, statehood, you know, formal recognition by the United Nations. And so meanwhile, elsewhere on the planet, in fact, it was my friend Lisa from San Diego that was trying to get in, and she'll probably be calling in tonight. Because the article that she posted last week was Resource Wars, identifying that not only have we been running out of cobalt, you know, and I have no idea how valuable that is, but apparently we've been running out of it since 1982. You know, Congressional Budget Office determined that we would probably have to, you know, wage war somewhere to get, you know, an adequate supply of cobalt. So there's any number of resources in the Congo that apparently they can't get anywhere else on Earth a sufficient supply. They've got to go back in there and get, you know, more, you know, by oil and by blood, as it were. So I invited Mark to come on here because Mark is actually the guy who I met here, you know, in the Western Plains region that discovered that there were Geiger counters at the scrapyards.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm going to let you tell that part of it, Mark, to Ruth Ann, if you guys haven't met already.
Yeah, just briefly there. A couple times. So anyway,
Mark? Yeah. No, I was going to say, go ahead. Yeah. Okay.
Well, we live in a small area around here, me and Vince, and we occasionally venture down to take some of that stuff to the scrap yards, you know, cans, and, you know, I try to recycle and all that stuff, so they recently installed some drive-through, what would you call them, Vince? Kind of a towers or whatever on each side of the road.
Right. Yeah.
Come in there, but we got curious, looked online at, was it Ludlam brand?
Yeah, Ludlam Measurements. If you want to look them up, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, well, yeah, they were somewhere out of Texas. I remember Texas. It's been a while since we talked about it, but they were, I think, by the, what we could tell by the pictures and everything, they spent, well, the minimum price would have been $7,000 for these machines. So just to monitor crap that was coming in that was, radioactive of any type. And I think, what, some of the options you could have, that was an installation or nothing. That was just base price up to $12,000 on that one model of different options. So,
yeah, they go up to
a lot of radioactive scrap to pay for that.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah. Your banker kind of has to look at you kind of funny if you're going to go down and borrow it. You need how much to detect some radioactive?
Up to 70, yeah, up to 70,000. They went from like 10,000 up to 70,000 on the price list that you printed out that I saw at the time. But you see pictures of them on our discussion group. It's called Occupy the Salvage Yards. Check the water heaters.
Yeah, and we've went to other scrap yards, talking to them, and we always kind of get inquisitive, and they, most of them are pretty cooperative with us. They don't know our objective, I guess, but so we've heard them. They come down, the one out there in Norton, said that he just recently had one, and he didn't have to get within 15-20 foot. They don't have the drive through they had handhelds, but he said it was hot enough he didn't have to get even close enough to it to have it go off. Drill stem pipe. He said he gets a lot of that from, down around Waukini, and which would be just along I-70 there, west of Hayes, Kansas.
Yeah, so that's about, 50 miles from where you're at?
Yeah, 50, 60 miles south, southwest a little bit. And, man, well, we've looked around, and I tell Vince that these, most of them always said it's drill stem pipe, pieces of drill stem pipe. Sucker rod's all right, but it's a drill stem pipe, but we see it up for sale at auctions, livestock auctions, but consignment auctions and farm sales, and most always livestock auction facilities are all made out of it because it was cheap and plentiful at the time. It may be 20, 30 years old, some of it, but they're just loaded with drill stem pipe.
So let me break in and say that this is like 2-inch pipe, and the reason why it's radioactive is because they're using it for fracking. They're using the drill stem to get rid of radioactive wastewater. And we're talking millions of gallons that they can force down a well and call that, with hydraulic fracturing. They're literally forcing, millions of gallons into an area that is going to fracture, under the extreme pressures.
Right.
Okay. And so these Geiger counters, as it were, stand up, Geiger counters, show up in scrap yards and also in like train yards.
Yeah, because what we have acquired from asking these owners of these scrap yards is that, all right, if they send out a piece that's radioactive, they have to go out there and pick it out of the place themselves, all right? They can't where they have to hire one of those, what was it, kind of crews. It was just something that they're for hire to remove a piece of radioactive metal.
Yeah, I don't remember what they call this.
Expensive, you know, in case you had to go clear out to the East Coast or something. You know, they tracked it all the way out to New York or somewhere out in there. You know, you'd have to go out there yourself or have one of these services come take rid of, you know, it could be only the size of a, you know.
Are you thinking of hazmat?
Huh?
Are you guys thinking of hazmat?
No, it's not hazmat. It was
okay.
What was that, Vince? Do you remember that list of people that was contactable on that thing we printed out?
Well, they have to be, you know, certified to handle, you know, hazardous materials. So,
that's what hazmat is.
Yeah. So, but I don't remember the name of the specific type of crews that, you know, like, I mean, it's oil field service companies that might go out and you know, they hire them just to go out and pick up scrap, you know, salvage, you know, from the, you know, because they can't allow it to go to the smelters because the smelters have even more sophisticated Geiger counters, as it were. You know, and then they'll back charge the salvage yard that it came from. They can, you know, it's all tracked with RFID, you know, radio frequency identification on all of the shipping containers. And so, you know, they don't want to have their recycled steel, as it were, coming out radioactive, you know, radioactive bridges. It's not because they care about people's welfare. It's because, you know, somebody could fine them for using radioactive metal, you know, in their new construction.
Right.
So it's almost like, well, going back to the, you know, the reason why they're so desperate to get rid of the radioactive water is because there are a growing number of people who know how to track, you know, radioactive waste. And so if they can't get rid of it, then, you know, then it's like the old maid. You know, they get caught, you know, holding the radioactive material, then, you know, then they have to pay to dispose of it. But if they can give it away, and that's what they were doing with this drill stem, you know, is that they were having to give it away because the radioactive material becomes embedded in the pipe. You know, they can't, you know, sanitize the pipe by steam cleaning it. So they're trying to get rid of the pipe because the radioactive material becomes embedded in the pipe. It'll also cause the pipe to corrode at an accelerated rate. You know, so that's why they're trying to get rid of it. If they could just use it over and over, they'd continue to use it for 10 years, you know, then get rid of it. You know, it looks like they're having to get rid of this stuff after, you know, a couple of years.
Yeah, because it looks pretty good pipe. Decent, anyway. You can tell it's been used.
So the reason why we're referring to, you know, the discussion about Occupy the Salvage Yards, we've actually got a picture of from the EPA website showing what these Geiger counters looks like. But we're telling people all they got to do is call up the scrap yards and ask, well, where do I take the drill, you know, where do I take this this old pipe that I got laying around?
Right. Okay, we do have your friend Lisa, our friend Lisa, that you've talked to more than I, is on the line. Hi,
hey.
Lisa. Hi.
Hey. Hey, guys. How's it going? I'm sorry. I'm just now tuning in, so I need to repeat anything that was already talked about. I wasn't able to download the station. So, what's going on? Hi.
That's Vinnie and Mark is with us, too. I'm Ruth Ann.
Hello.
Now, No, Lisa, I explained about the resource wars as far as what I can remember from the article. I don't have it in front of me. Could you kind of summarize, you know, how you found that or where you found it? You know, because you've been on the front lines with the Palestinian,
I sure have. That's been a main concern of mine. But the resource wars, you know, basically we can assume that it's in epidemic proportion. You know, the civil war in the Congo may cause big problems for millions of cell phone and computer users across the globe, because the Congo's the third largest producer of tantalum. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, tantalum.
That sounds right.
Okay, yeah. It's used in high-tech electronics, and even a temporary supply shortage may deal a serious blow to electronic industries and far-reaching consequences for other branches, because the situation in the Congo is just one example of how regional conflict may affect the lives of millions of people, you know, on other continents, you know, including our own.
Now, if you do a search, I just throw back, you know, to find the article on resource wars, I think you could probably just type in resource wars on the FB search bar.
You can go to lisaleaks.com, and there's an article there, how it kind of breaks it down of what's going on in the Congo, and then you know, it's why the United States invaded, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, were for these mineral rights that China had scooped up, you know, before the United States had. And that's why the United States is, you know, trying to bring, you know, legal suits against China. Because although the tribal and the clan feud, the ongoing bloodshed in Central Africa country is actually a war for mineral resources. The rebels seized Goma, the biggest city in the mineral-rich eastern part of the Congo, and are poised to fight, you know, with the government troops and UN forces, yet unable so far to check their advances. But the rebels, who call themselves the March 23rd Movement, or...
Okay, March 23rd, That's what I wanted to find out.
That's what it
is,
March 23rd Movement.
That date shows up in the takeover of Hungary in 1944.
A long time ago.
Yeah, and so it meant something to the Nazis, and I haven't found out yet, you know, going back to March 23rd, but I saw this in South America when I was down there. They would essentially take an anniversary, like, say, September 19th, and then that became the name of the rebel movement, you know.
Right. But it's not really about the rebels so much. That's all kind of the guys, you know, because the Congo has vast and largely untapped reserves of oil, gold, diamonds, copper, uranium, cobalt, and other minerals, including this tantalum, which is interesting to me because it's a rare earth metal used in the nuclear power industry, and also mobile phones, computers, digital cameras, and other high-tech products.
Okay, now the question I have, if someone can look up tantalum, do you have the spelling there, Ruthann?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Well, you mean where the name came from?
In other words, is it on the element table? Because this comes back to my discussions earlier on other forums about mining as chemistry.
Mining as chemistry?
Yeah, right. Because, in other words, when I found out that the cement plant in the mountains where I lived, you know, the cement plant had been around for 100 years, and they started hiring chemical engineers. Okay, so you got to think of mining as chemistry. Because,
right,
you know,
and you're probably way over my head as far as that goes.
I'm going to simplify it. If you look at tantalum, you know, it's either an element or it's made up of elements.
Right, it's a mineral, so yeah, it's an element.
Okay. Back, you know, when I was in school, some of us learned the element tables. I didn't because, you know, my math scores weren't high enough to take chemistry. Which, you know, I hear people laughing because I can actually visualize, you know, how the elements fit together, you know, if I know the name of an element. This was a discussion that we were having in 2010. When I found out that the borax plant in the Mojave Desert was owned by Rio Tinto. And so one of the things I want to start doing, Lisa, and you guys, you know, the rest of you, is taking apart what companies are fracking the Congo. That's our new discussion group. It's called Fracking the DR, or Fracking DR Congo. But essentially looking at what they do if they, you know, start, you know, after they strip mine, you know, the surfaces, you know, and I'll make a general statement, that all of our open pit mining around the world is tied to nuclear and chemistry.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, there's uranium in that there sand pile. When I was talking to Mark earlier, was it you, Mark, that was telling me about they're starting to dredge the Missouri and Mississippi?
The Mississippi? I mentioned that the Congo River, they found out, was almost 600 feet deep there on a show I'd seen on TV. It makes it the deepest river in the world.
Oh, you were talking earlier about the sand and the fracking, and you were saying that on the Mississippi they were taking
they were trying to get some permits there between, I believe it was Kansas City and like St. Joe up along on that part. I don't think it was St. Louis, but I think it was on the Missouri River maybe. But
okay.
They were talking they needed, some company was trying to open a sand pit for the fracking industry.
Oh.
So much sand to do that.
Yeah, they're using so much sand. You know, and I'll just briefly explain what the sand is used for. When they frack the reservoirs, they flush it with sand so that the sand will keep the vents open. You know, so the oil and the gas will flow out of it. So I want to give Lisa's website out again. Lisa Leaks, LEAKS, LisaLeaks.com.
It's pretty much broken down there as to, you know, about that really where that the U.S., you know, this battlefield is really between Beijing and Washington, because China has invested and continues to invest billions of dollars in Africa and made it a priority of its foreign policy. As a result of the war, Sudan split into two separate states. Sudan and South Sudan.
Yeah, that was last summer that they finally split, but they've been a mess ever since.
They've been a mess ever since, but, you know, it is over the, you know, the growing demand of these, of the minerals. The demand for the tantalum is growing faster than the supply, and it's fueled by rapidly developing, you know, high-tech branches of this tantalum, which is more profitable than gold or diamonds. And for Congo's poor neighbors, control over the tantalum deposit could mean, you know, a chance for an economic breakthrough and higher living standards for them. And although it produces, there's stockpiles, yeah, sufficient quantities of this tantalum, and the situation there is very alarming, you know, and it's prompting scientists to look for, you know, alternatives. This is really a war between China and the U.S. over mineral rights.
Yeah, and that's going on in South America and all over the world. You know, just to say that China is actually using tax dollars to, you know, to buy up all of these resources. And I just saw a report in the Wall Street Journal that says that, you know, the countries that are all for free enterprise and Western-style democracy in Latin America are all, making money hand over fist. And then in the same, you know, paragraph, they say that, you know, China is a major player in getting all of these minerals. So, in other words, if you allow, you know, the majors to strip mine your country, then your GDP is going to go up and up and up, you know.
Well, you know, you guys, it looks like to me we got to get into, like, electronics recycling.
Yeah.
You know, if we're throwing that much money into the trash, into our landfills, it might save a few lives in the future.
That's a good point. We should be able to determine, you know, and this is what they do with electronic recycling, is they ship it to, like, Bangladesh. You know, and then they have people burn it and melt it down or what have you, and then extract the minerals.
Yeah, and it could be just, I mean, for many countries, control over mineral resources is actually a matter of surviving. For the elites, it's an opportunity to enrich themselves uncontrollably. You know, wars for resources may assume, you know, like I said, epidemic proportion. And that's why we are over in the Middle East. It is for the mineral rights, not just the oil, but all these other minerals.
Well, there's minerals in the oil, and see, they can use mining, or oil, actually drilling, and production to extract the minerals, through the pipelines, and that's why the drill stem, you know, on these, the pipes and the drill pipes are becoming radioactive, is because there's uranium, you know, in the stream of oil and gas.
Right.
Now, have you seen that offshore Syria? If you type in offshore Syria, you'll find out that there's an offshore, gas deposit between Turkey and Cyprus and Palestine. I'm really curious about, you know, why they're using tantalum at all. You know, what is so special about this rare earth mineral that it's worth, killing millions of people to obtain it? It reminds me of unobtainium in the movie Avatar.
Yeah. Yeah, quite similar, doesn't it?
Right? So they create a demand for something that everybody has to have, for their, and back when there were buffalo, then everybody in Europe found the buffalo hide coats became fashionable in Europe at a time when they wanted to remove the buffalo. The same with their beaver, lined hats. They've always found a use for the resources that allowed them to go in and justify strip mining. And see, once they finish strip mining, and you'll find this out if you go to Rio Tinto's website, is that they discovered uranium in Madagascar. okay? But they don't want to pay for you, you know, extracting uranium. So they're just taking out the bulk ore. They pay like $110 or, you know, it's either $100 a ton or $1,000 a ton. But they only have to pay for the bulk ore. So what they do is they take it out of the country and then they refine it elsewhere. It's refined, as it were, overseas from, you know, instead of it being refined in the country, they only have to pay for the bulk tonnage. They don't have to pay for, you know, the minerals in the ore.
Yeah, then the U.S. and NATO forces that have invaded, they knew far before 9/11, the 9/11 attacks, what really after. You know, we're the last to know, you know, what was going on as far as that argument. But the 2001 bombing, the invasion of Afghanistan, has been presented to the world public opinion as a just war, you know, a war directed against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, a war to eliminate Islamic terrorists and instate Western-style democracy, right, democracy. The United States, you know, it's just the global war on terror, it's about these rare earth minerals and obtaining.
Right. No, I just posted last night on a discussion. I haven't started the discussion yet, but essentially calling on, I sent it to a guy in Malaysia, calling on a grand jury of nations, essentially the 12 nations that were hit by the tsunami in 2004, you know, when they were fracking offshore Sumatra. And we also suspect that they were nuked, you know, but that's a different, you know, discussion. And that's why I mentioned that if they start fracking in the Congo, then they, you know, essentially, you know, turn that swamp into a tsunami. I'm curious as to where all that, you know, swamp water, you know, flows into and out of. As Mark mentioned, the Congo has the deepest river, you know, channels on Earth.
Yeah, huge amounts of untapped natural gas reserves have remained, you know, there. And
well, see, underneath the natural gas, and this is one of the reasons why we started talking about calderas, that, you know, that essentially there's molten salt under, you know, that their gas field. And, you know, molten material, so, you know, starts with, you know, molten salt, and then other minerals, you know, melt, and it all just becomes, you know, one just, you know, pool of magma. But that's essentially what they tapped into in the Gulf of Mexico, is, you know, essentially drilling right into a caldera.
Yeah.
And so they figured out a way to essentially vaporize, you know, seawater or swamp water and turn it into natural gas. See, now the earthquake activity, you know, since we started studying this back in 1991, and today you can type in Aquifer Philippines and you've got who was poking holes inside of the mountain, you know, the seamount in 1991. It's quite possible they were active in Japan at the same time, because in June of 1991 there were eruptions in Japan, followed by, you know, eruptions in the Philippines in July.
All right.
So that's what essentially what we want to look at is what companies are underwriting this venture. You know, in other words, is it British Mining? Is it, you know, a consortium of mining, you know, oil, gas? Who is it that's paying for the military? you know, besides all of this, you know.
You can't leave out the Vatican.
Oh.
No, no, they seem to want to, you know, put their solution, as it were, you know, and just kind of to digress, that the thing with the Palestine will be settled by the partitioning of Jerusalem.
I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
I'm going to go on record and say that's the ending for Palestine, is the partitioning of Jerusalem between, you know, Jews, Christians, and Muslims.
Well, I don't think that the Palestinians can take the bid that they've been offered.
Oh, no.
No way.
Well, go ahead and elaborate a bit on that. I think that you and Ruthann are more versed in that area than Mark and I.
Go for it, Lisa. I just interject occasionally. It's not my show, so go for it.
Are you there, Lisa?
I am. I'm here. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Could you elaborate a little bit? You know, kind of summarize, you know, what the deal was that they gave the Palestinians.
Well, they don't have a legitimate seat, basically. You know, they don't have the full force of the. Of what the other, you know, United Nations have, they just don't, and they shouldn't take the deal.
Well, they're going.
I'm glad they're celebrating, but
they came in there for that. I mean, they know that it's not the full power. They've been upped from the same thing as the Vatican, which was an entity, to now, you know, it's higher. But no, it's not what they should have for sure. But, you know, that this was, I don't know, I mean, there's a lot of celebrating just because 138 nations in the world recognized that they are, that they exist, actually, and they voted against Israel. So that was the, you know, when the world woke up. And so it's a good thing, but there's still so far to go.
There is. There's a long way to go.
Yeah.
And it's gonna be an ugly battle, you know, until it's done. And I have to say that, you know, radio shows like this, social networking sites, most people, you know, most taxpayers, yeah, simply really aren't aware, you know, of you know, exactly how their money is spent in Israel.
Yeah.
To finance, you know, openly racist, you know, killing of innocent people. It's just, I mean, it's the worst atrocity, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Well, since the ceasefire, the Israelis have kidnapped 29 fishermen. They've shot at them. They've killed at least one young man this morning. There may have been two others that they've killed. I mean, they just haven't stopped at all since the so-called ceasefire.
Right, and that's funded by the United States.
$3 million a day, yeah.
Yep.
The country
it's an expensive puppet show.
Yeah.
So now, with our discussion about resource wars, okay, how do we help the people, you know, in the, and I'm looking at the region of the Congo, not as the country, but as all the countries that border that swampland.
Well, Well, I mean, you mean, are you talking about the Middle East? Because Afghanistan could eventually be transformed into one of the most important mining centers in the world, and that United States officials came out and said that. The Pentagon said that. It was in the New York Times that the United States identifies vast mineral riches in Afghanistan.
Well, see, the
last year I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia, the Pentagon memo, as I remember it, you know, for example, states that the Afghanistan could become the Saudi Arabia of lithium, you know, a key raw material that's manufactured, you know, for everything that we use, our technology, from our laptops to our Blackberries. The vast scale of Afghanistan's mineral wealth, you know, was discovered, you know, by a small team of Pentagon officials and geologists. I mean, well, way before, you know, I'm talking back in the 40s. Well,
right.
It could take many years to develop the mining industry, but the United States wants that, and the potential is so great that the officials and executives in the industry believe it could attract, you know, heavy investments, even more mines, or are profitable, providing the possibility of jobs, you know, and distant generations, you know.
And mines are immoral, I mean, because of, besides the damage they do to the environment, so many people are killed constantly in them, like in China. One thing we could do is encourage people to find other ways to keep the technology going without using these rare minerals.
Exactly.
That's exactly the point. You
hit
the nail on the head right there.
See, that's where our, you know, young people need to educate themselves, you know, not, you know, to get a job in the industry, but to essentially to what I call fracking the industry is taking it apart. That's why I say think of mining as chemistry, because after you get a grasp on that concept, then think about the frequencies of the elements. You know, these are things we weren't taught in school. They didn't talk about the frequencies of the elements. You know, that wasn't until, you know, recently when they started referring to plasma, you know, as the fourth state of matter, and that was a question that was on, are you smarter than a fifth grader?
Right.
Okay, so that's where I, you know, realized how important it was for us to understand that each of the elements resonates at a different frequency. That's how they're finding these rare earth minerals. They're using HARP, I believe, you know, to find, you know, these rare earth minerals.
Okay, that makes sense.
They look for these planets, you know, and they use spectroscopes and all that stuff. Gas is given away, and yeah, Vince's theory would sure coincide with some of that, because it's just electronics that they're using way, way out in the space to see if these planets have certain elements in them, even today. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
So how do we help the people of the Congo? I posted a picture today of two high school boys holding hands, sitting on chairs, in the town square. They're having to hold hands for an hour because they were, you know, engaged in a fist fight. And I thought about Abbas and Netanyahu. Okay, so it's a little bit too late for some of these guys to learn how to hold hands. Our military does not want our kids learning how to hold hands with, quote-unquote, the enemy.
Absolutely not. No.
You tie them together. Forcefully.
Yeah. No, but the our country makes so much. I mean, these people are making so much money from war. They don't want that to quit. They sell arms to all sides.
Yep.
And you know, they have no morals, no conscience. Greed is the name of their game.
Yeah.
At any cost. At any cost.
At any cost.
Where the quick fix is, and what is demonstrated and what is necessary, is that there's all these, if we turn this around by creating jobs, you know, for safe, renewable energy, you know, it absolutely has to happen now, and it would open up the job market if we switched gears. But like you say, the United States and other countries around the world are going to suck the life out of every living being, you know, and to the very last drop, when it's not necessary. We don't need fossil fuels.
Exactly. But see, this is where capitalism has, I mean, it's already breaking down. It's got to just be kicked all the way down. So other, what do I want to say, institutions can arise, because the capitalism is what is feeding this greed. It's just a vicious circle.
Yeah, I tell Vince, you know, with the way the climate is, you know, and it's slowly escalating, but we didn't listen to, you know, Revell and Al Gore in the 70s about it, but
right.
We went ahead and gave the rest of the world the poison pill of democracy and capitalism, but now
right.
We're going to probably get the, you know, all collapse, almighty kind of thing coming here for too long, because there's no way of taking it back. You know, they just seem like they just can't reel it back in now.
Right. We gave them McDonald's, you know, which was, of course, we knew that would, you know, kill everything. However, you know, a lot of countries, I just saw Kenya said no GMOs in here. A lot of countries, you know, have kicked out and just won't allow. Of course, the United States, well, Monsanto, what can you say? But other countries have some sense. And they really don't want to kill their people with GMOs and things. So that gives me a lot of hope right there.
But the United States is not on that bandwagon.
Oh, no,
it's
not
there. It's humiliating.
Yeah.
Well, and they're not united, so they're barely states.
Well, right. So many people are wanting to withdraw from the United States. I mean, like they said, people from all 50 states have signed petitions. They want to secede from the United States. So, yeah, there's a lot of unrest in this country.
Well, what I did was I invited the people of Canada and Mexico to secede as well. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, going province by province, state by state, you know, throughout Latin America, you know, there's a whole lot of states that are disgruntled with the, you know, the current state of affairs.
Yeah.
Right.
So I wanted to talk to you guys about something that Mark and I were talking about earlier. You know, we have a discussion called 100 Villages. That's number 100. With the word villages, it's spelled with a Z on the end. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what the concept is a lady that I was on the phone with earlier, and I'm going to have her on the show, you know, possibly next week, you know, mentioned the idea of building subdivisions. You know, out of modular homes. And then Mark mentioned, you know, using, you know, hemp panels to build those modular homes.
That actually sounds wonderful.
Where is that happening then?
Well, actually, we're now looking at what our resources are, you know, for building modular homes. The hemp panels, we've got to, you know, go on and find the resource. And Mark suggested we just go to Canada since they're already building things out of hemp.
Well, right. You don't have to rebuild the wheel or whatever. Yeah.
Okay. But there was an idea I came up with back in 1991 when we were watching what was happening in the Philippines. A group of us, you know, had a discussion in the prison where I work about how to turn a septic system into a fuel cell. Now, we weren't using the term fuel cell because the never, you know, we didn't know anything about the concept of fuel cells. So what we called it was a binary, you know, reactor, turning your septic into hydrogen by running it into a tank that's halfway filled with molten salt.
Salt?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, in other words, you know, there's a number of ways to melt salt, and one is to run battery power, and incidentally, our discussions about using, a HARP array as an arc welder, essentially, you've got high voltage, or actually high wattage, up to a billion watts of power. It hits the ionosphere, bounces back. It's looking for a lightning rod.
And this is being used now.
What's that?
This is being used now.
Yeah, in 2010, that lightning rod was that rig in the Gulf of Mexico. There's evidence that it was struck by lightning that burned through the heliport.
Wow.
You know, to find the power supply on the rig. So our geophysics friend has pictures of it. And I found the same pictures on a YouTube video in 2010. Or actually 2011. Because they also included photos of what looked like a Harpoon missile hit that reactor in Japan. Right? You got a punch-through hole. It looked like, like the reactor in Japan was hit by the same type of missile that hit the Pentagon in 2001.
Oh.
So, I tell people, I say, they were hit by everything that we had in 9/11. They were hit by directed energy. They were hit by HARP. There was actually a hurricane forming in New York Harbor. It's called Hurricane Erin, E-R-I-N. And
yeah.
That's on the interviews with Dr. Judy Wood.
Yeah, and I really appreciate all the work that she's done, and she definitely has some valid, observations. But I also work for the 9/11, the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth Movement, and they basically debunked a lot of her theories.
We only have like 30 seconds. Vinny, thank you. Please come in. This has been excellent.
Thanks for letting me. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I look forward to being able to chime in again if you guys will tolerate me.
Right. Okay, Vinny, do you want to wind up right now?
Well, I thank you all for making this open forum discussion a reality. It's been a long time since the last time Mark and I did what was called Friday Night Frack Book. So we're back to, having these discussions on Monday nights, and maybe eventually we'll have them, back on Friday nights. Friday Night Frack Down. It was a wrestling term. But,
right.
Yeah, we're starting a new discussion next week, so be sure to tune in. This is not the Jesse Jones Alex Ventura show.
Good.
We're gonna talk about the truth, and then we're gonna talk about solutions. Thanks again, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
guys.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks.